2023-3, moved by Councilor Haskam, second by Councilor Ryland. Be it resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby reconvene into regular open session of Council at
6:33 p.m.
Call the question. All those in favor? None opposed? Carried. Resolution 24-334, moved by Councilor Zulak, second by Councilor Pekkanen. Be it resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby accept the reports, recommendations, and directions arising from the closed session held June the 4th, 2024. Call the question. All those in favor? None opposed? Carried. In the spirit of reconciliation and cooperation, we wish to acknowledge that the land in which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and the Mississauga people. Its boundaries fall within the Robinson Huron Treaty of 1850 and the Williams Treaty of 1923. We are grateful to live here, and we thank all the generations of people who have taken care of this land for thousands of years. To honor the suffering of Indigenous people and the love and wisdom they have carried for thousands of years, we pledge to work in community and harmony with each other and the environment we inhabit, and work towards truth and reconciliation. In session now, so we'll take the roll call again.
Councillor Morley Haskell.
Councillor Nick Ryland.
Councillor Debbie Zulak.
Councillor Mike Hekkonen.
Acting Clerk Administrator Carly Britton.
Fire Chief Robert Morrison.
Deputy Chief David Benchoff.
And Mayor David Moore. Any declarations of pecuniary and or personal interest in the general nature thereof? Hearing none. Resolution 24-335, moved by Councillor Haskam, second by Councillor Ryland. Be it resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar is hereby give bylaw number 2024-48, being a bylaw to appoint a deputy fire chief for first and second reading. Further read a third time and passed in open council this fourth day of June 2024. Mayor Rob.
Well, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to Council and our Mayor, David Moore. My recommendation for our Deputy Chief, Dave is a resident of our community since 2020. He brings 29 years, a wealth of experience to the department, and we're really looking forward to working with him for the foreseeable future. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to, Dave, if you want to go up to the Mayor. All
right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here, do you want to just...
You've been well vetted, I think. If Rob supports you, then...
Looking forward to getting started.
Yeah. Great. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Now,
keep your speech under half an hour.
Half an hour. I didn't
really prepare much. I said you thought.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Call the question, then. All those in favor. For those who just came in, we moved some items around, so 21.1 has been moved up to the beginning, and 17.1 is also being moved up. So we have Resolution 24-336, moved by Councilor Zulak, second by Councilor Pekkanen. Be it resolved, the Council of the Corporation of Township of McKellar does hereby receive the opening results from the request for proposal number 2024-10 for painting and caulking of fire station number 2, and further defer to the decision to award and decline the RFP of the June 18, 2024 meeting of Council. And for discussion, I guess Rob is going to speak to it. So,
just some facts about the RFP. We had only two responses, one of which was from the gentleman that you just met. And he declared a conflict of interest in that submission, and the other was from a painting firm from down in the GTA. The firm from in the GTA submitted their RFP on the final day. There were some questions surrounding it, so upon contacting the firm from the GTA, I'm happy that we're deferring it because I believe we need some further investigation. various facts that went along with the conversation. But I'm happy that we're deferring and we can analyze this a little bit further.
I question, I guess, when the whole RFP was drawn up. There, I don't know whether you consulted with the office and the usual procedure for drawing those up, because what we like to do with those is that when they're open, that the public is available to come in so they can see who's bid and what the prices were, which we normally do with public works and different tenders that we put out.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was done quite differently through internet, I guess, or through RFP emails, and it closed at midnight. So
it did, yes. I used the standard template that we had used in previously, and just changed the dates and the parameters of the RFP accordingly. At any time, if anyone had requested, the details of the RFP could have been shared, and the RFP itself was located on the website. But I was made aware later that we typically also request a paper copy to be submitted.
Right.
So that was not something I was familiar with. So I didn't formally request it in the RFP itself.
Councillor Keckner.
So I do have concerns in regards to the conflict of interest, particularly bylaw 2019-44, purposes, goals, and objectives of this bylaw, and section L, avoid conflicts among the interests of the corporation, those of the corporation's employees, and councillors. And under the definition of conflict of interest, you can see that this is applicable. 5.06, no township employee or member of council may bid on any call for bids or sell or provide good services or construction to the township outside of their employment with the township. 5.08, all councillors, officers, and employees of the corporation shall declare any conflict of interest to the clerk administrator, and such person shall refrain from participating in the procurement process to which the conflict of interest relates.
Yes, I'm aware of that. The way that we handled it was because the gentleman involved is technically a volunteer. He is not considered an employee. We don't pay employment premiums for them. We went through and because he does own a successful business in that field, a request was made to him that if he was going to submit an RFP for it, that he do so with the declaration of a conflict of interest included, because there was the option to include a declaration of such. Going forward, the RFP was listed prior to him actually being given the position that he's currently in. So we figured that in the worst case scenario, he could submit an RFP and then council would then bring it to the floor and you guys could make the decision based on however you saw fit. We just tried to sort of dot our I's and cross our T's to make sure that we were following it as closely as possible with proper protocol.
So I think we need an investigation on the definition of employee, because they do receive a T4 slip, do they not?
Yes, they do.
Well, I think we may be able to resolve it if we have a reference to the code of conduct, and I'm not sure. I don't have it available right now, but I think we took care of, we included committee members, and I think we included volunteers, but I can't know for sure. That's why we have to refer to the code of conduct, which was passed out to all the different committees and all the different departments. So if we can check that as well, I think, it probably shouldn't have got to this stage. But I think we've halted it before it went any further, so I think we're okay.
Yeah. The intention was always that it would come to the floor, and quite honestly, I expected more of a response from the general bidders anyways, rather than just one bid, which effectively nullified itself because it was incomplete.
Right.
So did not imagine this situation coming to fruition. So, we are insulated from the fact that we did declare it a conflict of interest, and by all means, the intention was for you guys to be able to make the decision.
Yeah. Any other discussion? So this is deferring the decision to award or decline until the next meeting, June the 18th, and then maybe we'll gather some information. Okay, call the question on deferral. All those in favor of deferring? Okay, carried. Okay, that's all we moved to the beginning. So I guess the bylaw will have to wait until we get into bylaws. That's your
problem.
I'm just wondering if you have to go to practice as well, so training. We can correct that. I mean, we said 17.2, which was removed from the agenda, and we could add the 21.3 and 21.4. Yeah.
Maybe I'll just do a separate resolution now.
Okay. I'm more than willing to also stay if it passes with your schedule. One of Dave's major responsibilities is training, so that has relieved the pressure on me on a Tuesday night to a certain extent.
I think this is fine. We're holding off the public meeting and the delegation, so that's fine. I think we can do this first.
Fair
We have resolution 24-337, moved by Councilor Kekkonen, second by Councilor Zulak. Be resolved, the Council of the Corporation of Township McCullers hereby move items 21.3 and 21.4 to precede item 10.1, the public meeting. Call a question, all those in favor? Not opposed, carried. We have resolution 24-338, moved by Councilor Ryland, second by Councilor Haskin. Be resolved, the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar does hereby give bylaw number 2024-38, being a bylaw to prescribe times for setting fires and precautions/restrictions for burning, and to repeal bylaw number 2019-24 as amended, first and second reading, and further read a third time and passed in open council the fourth day of June 2024. Okay, I have a number of questions, but I'll let you.
Well, so go ahead with questions first.
That's okay. And I'll open up to council here, certainly, too, if you have any concerns. I just tried to simplify, and I hope that your concerns were implemented in the new one that came out here.
Absolutely. That's so fantastic. Absolutely.
And I think the big thing we're coming away from this is council had said, too, that the burn permits aren't required except for the special events, any daytime burning as such, and anything that you can permit.
Correct.
At certain times when no burning is allowed, you could still override that.
That is correct. Yeah, we corrected the 2019 version, which inadvertently installed the permit process. Yes. The one point that I feel important to raise with reference to Section 5, which I don't know if it is in your copy or not. It was a last-minute communication that I had with the MNR legal department, and it was our changes to the bylaw here, everything is completely acceptable. In conversation with our MNR representative, in all of our efforts to make this as unambiguous a bylaw and easy to understand as possible, the simple wording at the end of 5.1c being any time of day during a low, moderate, or high fire danger rating should also include, just for point of clarity, for cooking purposes. That communication didn't come until yesterday, so unfortunately it wasn't included.
So what does that do to our title that precedes 5? It talks about campfire recreation fires.
Campfires and recreation fires also includes, in definition, a fire for warmth or cooking.
Okay.
So you can.
You wouldn't have to be cooking something, but
theoretically, it is advised by the powers that be that if you were going to have a daytime fire, generally speaking, you don't need them for warmth. It should be for cooking purposes. Outside of the normal prescribed by burn times of 6 p.m. to 10 a.m.
Yeah, and I'm very happy to see a 5C in there because that was not the case in the past, right?
You couldn't have.
And that's been very disappointing for a long time. I've had a lot of people say, you know, you got friends over, you want to cook a meal on your little fire pit at 5 o'clock, and you can't. You got to wait till 6. So I think this is just wonderful news for everybody in the township that now that they can go out with family and at any time of the day and have a fire as long as it's a low, moderate, or high kind of thing. So I think it's just wonderful. Adding for cooking purposes, yeah, if that's what's being advised, that's fine too, because that's going to be the case in 95%.
Yeah, ultimately, you can have your grandchildren over and put hot dogs over the fire at lunch essentially what it's intended to be, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic news.
I'm very happy with the efforts that was put by council on this bylaw. I think it's very progressive and it definitely does open it up a bit. So
I was interested. I was looking at McDougall's. It's about 3 pages long.
Yeah.
And this one's what? 12?
I mean, you have to shoulder some of that.
And some of the things that, and this is what I'm getting at too, because they talk about the distance.
Yes.
And from flammable materials,
yes.
Which to me is even worse than combustible, probably, because they can't ignite immediately, rather than combustible, which may ignite.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got 2 meters from flammable materials in McDougall.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going with 8 throughout. I put in 3, but...
We are going with 8 for, and just a point of clarity, and sorry to interrupt you there. We're going with 8 for debris fires and incinerator fires. We're going with 3 for campfires and cooking fires.
Right.
So if you are, if you're clearing your property of down trees, stuff like that, that it tends to be a bigger fire, 2 meters by 2 meters. So you want that extra buffer there because the amount of heat transference... If you were 3 meters away from, let's say, a building with vinyl siding, you would melt the siding on a 2 meter fire. Right?
See, this is what I'm confused about the whole process, how municipalities differ. And the legislation, one that you had crossed out, was right out of legislation from the province. This was back to 4M. And it just says a safe distance from combustible structures. I know that's very open. What is a safe distance? And I was looking through some of the legislation again, and I don't see 8 anywhere in that legislation. So I know the municipality can override, in a sense,
yes.
Make it more restrictive than the province. But I guess you're saying the 8 has a meaning to it. Why would not have the same meaning in other municipalities?
There are a lot of municipalities that have 10 or 15 meters.
I need names because I've just mentioned McDougall, it doesn't.
Yes, Gravenhurst, let's say. I believe it's 15 meters.
I'm thinking of our area here.
Okay.
And I don't want to put you on the spot. But.
Yeah, no, off the top of my head, I can gladly come back to you with the distances for all the townships around us. But 8 was what we had previously established in the bylaw back in 2019. I'm not familiar. I don't remember what was in the 2018 version prior to changing that. But 8 was definitely in the 2019 version.
Oh, I know.
Previous version. And so that was just a maintaining it. It's
and the reason I questioned it, as I said before, you take most of the properties in the village.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for them to meet that 8 meters.
But that's for the biggest fires.
Right.
For campfires and so forth.
Well, I'm just saying even the people in the village might have debris to burn.
Yeah. And
you're saying they can't.
No. You can apply for a special exemption. And if in your case, when I go and visit, and we establish that, okay, in this area of your property, actually, you may not have the full 8 meters. Because part of the problem is that 8 meters also includes imaginary lines in the sand like your property line. But if you have to be within 3 meters of the property line, but then across that property line is a farmer's field, or another 15 meters of clearance, then then that's the kind of thing where common sense would come into play. Like, okay, like we can work with this. Technically, it doesn't meet the 8 meters in all directions, but we can work with you in this scenario and say, okay, let's as long as you have it in this location, then I'm satisfied with the safety of that.
You see, that's what we're going at the council. I think the common sense that you just mentioned, that people do know, without having to call in a fire chief who may say, no, you can't burn. With common sense saying that, well, I've burned here for the last how many years, and I take all these precautions, I have everything prepared, and nothing's going to happen here that they know of anyway. And yet, I'm just saying, if you rely on an outside source to come in and shut you down, is that really, again, discrimination for certain people and the size of the property that they have?
Yeah, I don't think that the intention
was
ever to be discriminatory when it comes to certain things. You know, it's more or less in the greater interest of the public safety. When you're talking about smaller properties, you're talking about dwellings that are closer together, you're talking about more of a likelihood of greater involvement when something does go wrong in terms of properties and buildings and so forth that do not belong to the person who's actually setting the fire. So I did my best to accommodate everybody as much as we can. I'm sure like any situations will come up where I'm not going to be able to make 100% of the people happy, but I definitely will endeavor to do so as much as possible with the exemption.
Councilor Kagan?
Yes, sir.
I think we need some clarification on the comment that Councilor Haskin made when it says definitions. Open air fire means a fire situated outdoors, whether burned in a container or on the ground, and includes a chimney, a campfire, recreational fire, debris fire, and an incinerator fire, but does not include an outdoor campfire device. And terms and conditions of an open air fire. So I just read the definition of open air fire.
Mm-hmm.
Definition of open air fire. No person shall set, maintain, permit, or cause to be set or maintain an open-air fire in the township other than in accordance with the following. Where a permit is required, daytime burning, or special event, the permit shall be available for inspection at the property upon request. And that was A, and then N. Permitless burning is between the hours of 6 p.m. on one day and no later than 10 a.m. the following day. A daytime burning permit shall be required between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. And then general burning restrictions for campfire recreation fires, which are open air fires. C, any time during the day during a low, moderate, or high fire danger rating. So it's saying two things.
Hence the addition of those last three words that I just discussed for cooking purposes to try to clarify that point. If you were to have a campfire and you have hot dogs, then you are allowed to have it any time of day, any day of the week. The explicit intent of this was to be for larger fires, those of 2 meters in diameter, would require the greater clearance and also would require the daytime burning permit. And that's standard across the board in virtually every municipality, is that fires of that size, especially during daytime hours, require special permission because they are much more susceptible to going out of control.
Well,
especially in an extreme or higher, you're not allowed to have, we can't even permit daytime burning of a debris size during a high rating. It's cut off one level below what a campfire or cooking fire is.
I think it needs further clarification in the way that it's written because it's not clear, and particularly because by allowing fires during the day, which is the highest risk time for a fire to be taking place because of numerous factors,
mm-hmm.
after 6 p.m. the dew starts falling, the ground gets wetter, and the temperatures fall. Wind slows down. So now allowing for daytime burning without a permit opens up increased risk of fires, increased chances of fires getting out of control. We've never had daytime burning except without a permit previously.
Sorry, just to clarify.
We have
never
With a permit.
Yes, correct. Okay.
So now we're changing the rules completely and allowing for daytime burning.
For the purpose of cooking, yes. Yes.
Yeah. It was moved back to 4 o'clock in the previous bylaw.
At campsites only.
Right.
And the reasoning behind that was that the campsite assumes a certain portion of the liability when it comes to that type of fire for cooking purposes. So the campsites have an active role in maintaining the campfire areas around the campsites. So there's less chance for overgrowth, there's less chance for problems, right?
Would you cross that section out?
Yeah.
6.1.
Did I?
The 4 o'clock one.
Yes, because for cooking purposes now,
everywhere.
It would be anywhere.
Campground.
Yeah. Campsites to now only 4 o'clock and allow everybody else to do it at noon. So.
Yeah, as long as they're cooking something, I guess.
Yeah, and it's a 1 meter by 1 meter.
It's a 1 meter by 1 meter.
And somebody always has to be in attendance. So
those rules are set in stone. Somebody always has to be in attendance. So they have a certain age. They have to have methods of extinguishment. It has to fall within certain ratings on the FDR. And so there is an opportunity for that daytime fire to present a problem, of course. But going with the spirit of what we were discussing in previous meetings, of trying not to over-restrict and so forth, allowing a hot dog fire at noon, to me, was the lowest risk factor, as opposed to permitless debris burning, let's say, at any time, or massively reduced clearances or anything like that. So that's why I just sort of chose to maintain certain features of it and to try to be as flexible as possible on others. And I've fielded many phone calls over the 2 years that I've been here where somebody says, why can the campsite guys start at 4 and I have to wait till 6? And how my coals aren't ready till 7? Are they more responsible than me? I live here all the time. And so my answer is, that was the current established bylaw. I'm trying to take everybody's experience into account here and understand that across the board, we should be good to enjoy a simple cooking fire on our property.
I think that all of a sudden this opens the door up that any and all fires are going to be taking place, and someone's going to have a pack of hot dogs, beside the fire. So it's this.
But if that fire is over 1 meter.
And
it's in contravention of the bylaw,
yeah.
And it doesn't matter if you have a box of hot dogs sitting beside it, it's still not what the intent and purpose of the bylaw is for.
And I think it's going to increase the amount of calls you get with people calling because they're smelling smoke during the day, so people wanting to investigate how come there's a fire during the day.
It's
going to happen. Like it's a fact.
And it's entirely possible. And also, we still deal with people who, there are a percentage of the population who are already having daytime campfires for cooking, who are already having a daytime campfire at their college, and paid no mind to the fact, or had no idea that they weren't really supposed to. Right? So, again, the intention for all express purposes was to make this easy to enforce, easy to accommodate people, easy to understand, and open up certain freedoms that I don't think there is a lot of drawback to. You know what I mean? I'm sorry if I'm not expressing this effectively enough. As long as the conditions within the bylaw are met, then myself and the MNR both feel that there should be no significant increase in the risk to the township. Yes?
5A. So a campfire recreation fire, right, shall not exceed 1 meter in diameter.
I'm sorry, I missed the
word. Sorry. 5A, the campfire recreational fire?
Yes.
What is the times for that? Is that any time?
That falls within the campfire recreational fire. For cooking purposes, is allowed any time of day. A campfire, recreational fire, which is why we added those three words to the back end of C.
Yeah.
A campfire for just...
For a campfire.
Recreationally sitting around listening to music and so forth should fall within the hours that are prescribed by the MNR, which is after 6 p.m. And because it's not a necessity fire at that point. It's a fire for entertainment purposes.
But if they were cooking marshmallows or something, it would fall under for cooking, right?
They have
okay.
hot dogs.
All right.
Yes, I mean...
So basically they're the same.
Basically the same.
Okay.
But, you know, again,
we
rely on good judgment. We rely on best intentions.
Keep the mosquitoes away.
You could be cooking
trying
mosquitoes.
Cooking mosquitoes.
As Councillor Kekkonen stated in the previous meeting, in terms of the spirit of the bylaw, we're trying to encompass, and I'm sure Mayor Moore had that in mind when going through this, we're trying to encompass the spirit of what we think, you know, the northern community should be like. Right? So.
Sounds good.
Okay.
And I would have one more question, Rob, on the 5E, campfire, recreation fire, or a little 1 meter fire. Non-combustible materials dealing with here must be a minimum distance of 2 meters from the campfire. To clarify, so around, say, if you put your rocks, a 1 meter rock around, can you just have like lawn? Is that considered non-combustible?
There are lots of properties where you have the fire pit
mm-hmm.
is effectively the location in the middle of the lawn where they've had fires over the past number of years, and there's no confinement or containment whatsoever. In situations like that, we highly encourage 3 meters of clearance. In a situation like this, where the campfire is contained within a hand-built rock structure, masonry, on rock, or other non-combustible material, such as...
Tires.
No, tires, they burn, yeah. We don't encourage tire fires here in McKellar. We don't encourage those. But if it's contained within, let's say, you cut the top two-thirds off of a 45-gallon drum and you have a metal containment there, then from that standpoint, 2 meters would be... From that outer edge, 2 meters of clearance is sufficient.
From, I don't know if you answered my question or not, so outside my rock perimeter is lawn, grass, lawn, so I'd be okay then with that?
So,
or do you want patio slabs?
No, you would be okay with that, provided that you had met every other recommendation, which is all supervision and so forth.
So you
grass
would class
is
up.
Green grass
not
doesn't really burn that well
no.
when it comes down to it. Dry grass... I mean, you know, this is where we rely on our residents to use best possible practices and common sense and, not set the fire in the middle of the 3 foot high wheat field.
Yeah, that's a big thing too.
Why?
People having established fire pits on the property, because most of them probably by now have burned a lot of debris and had monstering fires, so they have burnt off any... what we've got to worry about is the roots, you know, going underneath where somebody's putting a fire. I've seen it for myself. I've set a fire that caught started a root fire, and the fire came above ground 50 feet over kind of thing. So I think a person has a really good fire and makes it, burns everything off, well, then we're good to go.
Yeah.
It's the new fire pits. So, but anyways.
Incredible how resilient fire is.
Yes. Yeah. But I'm willing to give everybody in the township an opportunity to show they're responsible. Sure, there's going to be the odd bad apple. And if it proves to be a problem after a year or two, well, we can revisit it. So in the meantime, when it comes for a vote, I think I'll be in favor of this as it is.
I think we've come a long way. I still have concerns, and I'd be interested to know the surrounding townships, what they do with the 8 meters. And so what I would recommend is 2 readings. And then we can get information on that, and whether we stay with the 8 meters or reduce it to 2 meters, as I know at least one municipality has done, or whether it be somewhere in between. I think that would be worthwhile to see, especially when regulation doesn't say 8 meters that I'm aware of.
I struggled with the 8 meters also, and I was thinking more maybe toward the six. What I'd hate to see somebody to start a monitoring debris fire any closer to somebody, to a property line or any other combustible material. Like, that's something you would do if you hated your neighbor, you know, start a monitoring debris fire kind of thing. So I'd like to still see a substantial distance, but I think the 6 meters, or the 20 feet approximately, is keeps people somewhat responsible.
Well, again, everybody is eligible to apply for an exemption, and depending mm-hmm. on the scenario and the situation, exemptions will be, you know, forthcoming. I mean, it's just a matter of I don't want to have blankets. Blanket rules can sometimes be a problem, right?
Again, that's why I think
yeah.
even checking with McDougal to see what problems they've had in the past with that distance,
yeah,
I think that would be worthwhile to look into.
As a just you know, as a person in my position, who has in my 25 years of firefighting seen a lot of very fast moving fires. The fire moves exceedingly fast, especially when you least expect it, and especially when you're least prepared to deal with it. And so, having a 2 meter fire, which is, you know, 6.6 feet, I believe,
yeah.
That is a lot of heat that can come off yeah. of that. And if the wind is going the wrong way, and if you happen to have the wrong scenario, the wrong things in the way, that fire will move in the wrong direction very fast. And so I just, as a point of experience, encourage the buffer. If it was up to me, I would have proposed 10, but I felt that going above what was previously already agreed upon in the previous bylaw would be problematic. Problematic. The entire logic behind 8 is not because it's written in stone anywhere else. It's not because, you know, it's a popular number. The document that I sent that had the guidelines for creating an open air burning permit, the one that was put together by the ministers of the environment.
Oh yeah, nobody would have any fires.
Yeah. They wanted 50 feet in some areas and 15 meters, and that was their recommendation. And yes, I agree, that's, you know, nobody's going to have it at that point in time. And sure, it would be super safe and all that stuff, but wildfires still happen and so forth. And there's no reason why we can't allow people to enjoy certain things. But again, the one point that I want to make sure that we're not confusing is that 8 meters is strictly for debris fires. It is strictly for burning the brush that's come down on your property. It is not for personal enjoyment. A debris fire was never intended to be for personal enjoyment or for cooking. I don't recommend having a 2 meter or a 6-7 foot fire for a good time. I recommend that for the express purpose of, like, property maintenance and so forth. When you are definitely not consuming anything of, you know, that will, you'll be inebriated when you're, you know what I mean? When you're on your game and you can do your best to contain it.
And see, what we have to weigh here, of course, a debris fire, whether it be, you know, branches, leaves, or whatever it be, we have to connect that with our transfer station. And what we have now is we have a policy for certain parts of the year, a couple months over the year, we will take some of those things, but the rest of the time we won't. Unless there's a charge to it, $30, I think, for a load. And so what people have to decide, too, then, and I know you don't want fires dotted all over the township, but if they have to either, can they burn on their own property, or do they have to start paying at the transfer station? And then the big problem we have at the transfer station is, where do we take all these, the branches that come in, because we're not mulching at this point. So we have to connect the two somehow that... if people can't burn a debris fire without getting a permit from the fire chief or a designate, which is another worry I have, because you don't know who's coming to inspect, and you might get different answers from different people on the department. So.
Well, it would be either myself or Dave who would come and do the exemption inspection.
But I think you've added a designate here, a volunteer, that you for different responsibilities.
Yeah, because he's... I've added the designate for a couple of different responsibilities. I don't know when I look, let me just item specifically for the
exemption? I don't think so.
Exemption, owner exemption can be made to the chief fire official, which is me.
And you go down to chief fire official or volunteers as designated by the fire chief and approved by council.
What's that section, Dave?
That's the definitions.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry,
chief
I have
fire official.
Okay.
I actually don't have that written online, so I must have a slightly different.
Oh, well, should be there.
So,
yeah, it's just what you have added is, as we had said, the chief fire chief for the township and township staff or volunteers. You added as designated by the fire chief and approved by council. So I think you were thinking of other firefighters who may be able to, you know, delegation.
Yeah, yeah. There will not be a volunteer firefighter going to your home to assess whether or not you can have an open air burning exemption.
Okay.
That would be my responsibility and my own. The only designation that I could fathom would possibly be to a deputy chief who has a comparable level of experience and so forth as myself. But no, that would be an exemption and a responsibility that I would bear. Intentionally, myself.
Well, I guess the council would bear some responsibility because it has to be approved by council.
Yeah.
Also, so if say if you were going to be gone for a month, you'd have to come to council and set that up, I guess.
Yes. And so, anyways.
Okay,
So I am still concerned about the daytime burning. Just because it doesn't align with Ontario Regulation 207-96, which talks about 2 hours before sunrise and 2 hours or sunset and 2 hours after sunrise, and it's for a reason because during the day the ground dries out, the wind picks up. You may have a nice little campfire place, but it's the sparks that are the issue. Sparks leaves fires, and if it's windy, that's where the issue is. So that's my concern, and if you feel that there is no issue with that, then we'll leave it in your hands.
I feel comfortable from the standpoint that I put the extra effort in to reach out to my M&R representative, and who included M&R Legal, and as a point of discussion, we talked about the possibility of allowing these fires, daytime fires for cooking purposes, and according to the M&R, a daytime fire for cooking purpose. For cooking purposes, is permitted. So it's not we're not reinventing the wheel. We're just opening up a right, a given right.
Okay.
So
it may be worthwhile, Rob, to have that in the green section over here. Just that a daytime cooking fire, is permitted. Well, we're in here, we're either in low or moderate, so
yep.
Matter of fact, we even have it under high, but, right? It's just that there's a lot of words to read through in the bylaw just
there
to
is,
find that out.
Yes,
right?
That graphic would actually, in fact, need to change because it does still list campsites as being 4 p.m. and so forth.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that green block was not green light.
Yeah, so that would now read a campfire rec fire for cooking purposes may be conducted any time of day, and that would stretch all the way from low to the high
correct.
Section. Yeah, so
correct.
If that could be done somehow on Schedule A, clarifying that, I think that's big for people when they read it, makes it so clear to
correct. Them. Yes, yeah. And we, in working with the MLCA, they were fortunate enough to receive the FireSmart grant, and so we've actually been assembling and putting together a brochure and so forth. A lot of the points in this bylaw, such as the one we've been discussing about daytime for cooking purposes, are going to be included in that. I'm just curious as to are we icing this for the next meeting or?
Well, I'm thinking here with some changes too that we do two readings. And
or there's okay, right.
And then you also get some public input.
Right.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah, there is one more point, and it's the cost of investigation enforcement as per section 16.1. mentioned this in a discussion with someone, and they've never seen officers being able to charge for according to their timesheets. Just to clarify, if the prosecution think that those are permissible costs that can be charged for.
My understanding, and perhaps Carly can speak to this a little bit better than I can, but under the Municipal Act, the township can levy those charges to the property owner to reflect that service. It's not a doesn't have to necessarily go through a crown. Is that correct?
I'd have to look into that further.
And I think it comes down there's fees and charges,
sure.
But are those reasonable expenses that you can charge for?
Well, so in terms of court officer, like being going to court and
occurrence and investigation time, officers' timesheets and related videos and photos, responding to a scene, officers' timesheets and related video photos. I know there's reference to the MTO rates for vehicles,
yes.
But for specific timesheets, I don't know if. If we can review that to determine if that's.
Absolutely.
I'm afraid
I don't have a rock solid answer for you on that one. This was established as part of the 2019 as well. So those fees haven't changed. The only addition and amendment to that fee table was that of the current MTO rate, allowing us to charge. If we have to, and again, this time, as we've discussed many times, I very much favor education over enforcement. You know, first time I go and see you, I'm certainly not going to be trying to levy anything, but, you know, if we have to repeatedly go back to the person who would like to have a 2-meter hot dog fire, then we may, through the township, start to levy MTO fees.
Okay,
so
thank you.
Wouldn't want to eat that hot dog.
Yeah, you're pretty burnt.
I don't prefer it very big. I don't know how to word it.
So are you proposing we would accept this as now for first and second, and then make amendments after the fact for the, before the third reading? Is
right.
That
that's
okay?
Usually.
That's what I understood. Just wanted to be sure.
Come a long way, and we'll get there.
Yeah,
but we'll definitely get there, and I think we'll have a very good document when we're done.
I think you've done a great job being flexible on this and finding ways to get things done without being onerous or restrictive. So, well, at least unduly restrictive. But anyhow, thank you.
So the amendment is the second clause, and further to be read a third time, instead of passed at open council on the 4th day of June, it now reads at the June 18th, 2024 regular meeting. We'll call first of all, vote on the amendment. All those in favor? And the poll is carried. Now on the amendment resolution. The resolution has amended. Call the vote. All those in favor? And the poll is carried. And one last one while you're here. Resolution 24-839, moved by Councilor Zulak, second to Councilor Tekkinen. Whereas bylaw 2024-43 was read for first and second time on May 21st, 2024. Now, therefore, be a result of Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKellar, does hereby give bylaw number 2024-43, being a bylaw to adopt the Township's Community Risk Assessment, a third reading, further passed in open council as 4th day of June 2024. Discussion? Didn't whether you wanted to add anything?
No. Adjustments were made. Ones that were brought up and encouraged, there were minor adjustments made to the plan to reflect those. Other ones were maintained based on advice from superiors, well-versed in the emergency management arena. And so this is I'm satisfied with the document in its current form, and if we pass it tonight, we will be producing printed copies.
Excellent. A lot of detail. Yes, Councilor Ryan.
Can I just ask, this is really just a housekeeping thing, can we have column headers appear on the subsequent pages, so page how we got to that 63 and 64 as well as page 62, right? It's just a column header thing, a table in Word. I know that's how it's done, so makes it a little faster if you open up to this page and don't know what any of that means. So.
Oh, okay. I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
Doesn't change any of the content, just readability.
Okay, any further discussion? Huh? Call the question, all those in favor? None opposed, carried. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Rob. Sorry for
you.
No, thanks for playing cards. Where do my meetings?
Now we're back to public meeting.
The giant fire of hot dogs.
Resolution 24-340, moved by Councilor Ryan, second by Councilor Baskin. Be resolved, the Council of the Corporation, Councilor McKellar, does move into a public meeting at
7:24.
7:24 p.m. to consider an application to amend the zoning bylaw for the subject properties 193 and 195 Menifee Drive. Call the question. All those in favor? None opposed. Carried. She's still online.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So this public meeting agenda, I'll call that to order. This is to review an application. We'll have J.R. Richards Planner, Rebecca Elphick, speak to it in a second. Are there any disclosures of public interest? And I need to know the general nature thereof if there are any. Hearing none. So if anybody, again, wants to go beyond council and beyond our planner, if anybody from the public wishes to speak, we just need your name. And all comments be addressed through the chair. And it's concerning primarily, well, solely, 193 and 195 Menifee Drive in the application. So I don't know whether, Rebecca, you want to speak to this or whether you want me to read out what it's all about. The better, you have the professional credentials to explain it better than I do. So.
Through you, Mr. Mayor, I'd be happy to present an overview of the report and offer some space for any questions or comments from members of council.
Okay, thank you.
So the application before you is an application to amend the zoning bylaw and proposes to rezone the subject property located at 193 and 195 Manitou Drive to a special provision of the waterfront residential 2 zone to recognize reduced lot area and lot frontage and several deficiencies in the required yards for that zone. The bylaw amendment is required as a condition of consent application B10-2024, which was provisionally granted by the Prezant Planning Board. The subject lands are two lots provisionally approved through consent application B10-2024. The land division was initially proposed through a previous application in 2021, at which time a provisional approval was granted. However, the 2 years lapsed where the applicants were required to fulfill a number of conditions. And so they were required to submit a new application, which is this one that was before the planning board. And as a condition of that, the rezoning was required of both the retained lot and the benefiting lands as well. The purpose of that lot addition was to rectify an encroachment of a detached garage over the property line between 193 and 195 Manitou Drive. And so from that application, approximately 150 square meters was severed from the property located at 193 Manitou Drive and added to the adjacent parcel at 195 Manitou Drive. The adjacent lands in the area are similarly developed with low-density seasonal residential uses along the shoreline Manitowoc Lake, and lands to the south beyond Manitou Drive are vacant. Both properties contain each a single detached dwelling and a number of accessory structures. Through our analysis, we can confirm that, or recommend rather, that the application is consistent with relevant policies of the 2020 Provincial Policy Statement, and those of the official plan for the Township of McKellar. The we propose that the retained lot be rezoned to a special provision of the waterfront residential 2 zone to recognize a reduced minimum lot area of 0.2 hectares, where 1 hectare is required, a reduced minimum lot frontage of 30 meters, where 90 meters is required, as well as a reduced minimum interior side yard based on the location of the frame sheds on that property. We're further recommending that the benefiting lot adjacent that's receiving that lot addition be rezoned to a special provision of the waterfront residential zone to recognize the reduced lot area, again, 0.2 hectares, a reduced minimum lot frontage of also 30 meters, and to recognize deficiencies in the minimum required front yard, interior side yard, and rear yard based on the existing locations of the detached garage and sleeping cabin. We do recommend that the existing development is does comply with all other requirements of the zoning bylaw and the waterfront residential 2 zone. It should be noted, though, that although the lot area was reduced from the remnant parcel through that consent application, slightly by that 150 square meters, the lot frontage of 30 meters for both of those two parcels is existing and remains unchanged by the lot addition. So we can consider that within the context of the application. And as well, the deficiencies in the front yard, interior side yard, and rear yard also remain unchanged by the lot addition, with the exception of the interior side yard of the benefiting lot, where the detached garage is located closer to that new lot line than what is required by the zoning bylaw. With that said, there is still some adequate separation to maintain between those buildings and the main property line, and in all cases that setback is greater than 0 meters, which maintains the intent and purpose of those provisions. And where there are deficiencies, the buildings and structures are small accessory buildings where lesser setbacks can be considered more appropriate. I'd be happy to answer any follow-up questions that members of council might have at this time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. There was one comment you just made there that not too much is really changing, that they're already existing, but you said anything, you mentioned the 0 meter setback. Just a question, I guess, why do we have actual setbacks like 2 meters, 3 meters, 5 meters if zero is acceptable?
Through you, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify that my comment was that the setbacks are greater than zero so as to maintain the intent and purpose of having a setback. So I believe the smallest setback that is proposed is in the minimum rear yard, where there's a 1.8 meter setback between the detached garage and the property line on the benefiting lot.
And everything is staying the same pretty well, as you said, with as far as frontage, 30 meters, but we had questions too, and with people online who will probably speak to this as well, with the road frontage. Are they both still 20 meter frontage on the roads?
Through you, Mr. Chair, the road frontage for the remnant parcel is slightly less than 20 meters. There is policy within the official plan which speaks to requirements for consents that would have been considered by the planning board. There is a section within that that portion of the official plan which allows for consents to be evaluated on their own merit, where they're proposed for boundary adjustments, correction of title, easements, and other purposes that do not create separate lots, which would be the case in this instance. And so that section that in the official plan which speaks to that 20 meters of road frontage, the intent and purpose of that section is to maintain safe access between adjacent properties, to ensure that there's adequate space for snow clearing, and that there's not going to be any conflicts from a transportation perspective. And I would recommend that the intent of those policies is maintained with this lesser 18.2 meters, I believe it is, of frontage for the remnant parcel. The official plan does allow for that to be evaluated on its own merit. And so I would recommend that that it does maintain the intent and purpose of those policies.
Now, the ones you mentioned, don't want to get too picky on this, but which category does it fall under in this case? You were listing some of the reasons why it could be less than 20. Which one?
In this case, I would recommend that it's it be considered a boundary adjustment, as the lot addition was meant to correct an encroachment of the detached garage over the property boundary between the two lots.
Now, would that have been required, though, if the garage hadn't been built? It's a boundary adjustment now, but that was a sort of a choice that wasn't a required boundary adjustment. It was by choice, was it not?
Given that the garage is in its location where it is now, I would see no other recourse for correcting that beyond the boundary adjustment. Given that it's only a small amount of land that's being conveyed between the two properties and that no new lot is being created, I would recommend that maintains the intent of that policy.
Any other questions from council at this point? And I would open it up to the public, either in person or on Zoom, if you have any particular questions.
Mr. Mayor, it's Ted Davidson Heights. I filed a letter with some comments. I don't know whether Rebecca has seen that letter.
Yes, apparently she has.
Well, there's a specific provision in the bylaw, section 3.15, that requires a minimum of 20 meters of road frontage on a waterfront lot where it has both water frontage as well as road frontage. It's not a matter of the Perry Sound Area Planning Board making a determination. This is a zoning bylaw, and I'm not opposed to the application, but just let's do it right and say the minimum frontage is 18 meters on the retained parcel rather than the 20. It's a minimum requirement in the bylaw. Also, I think these lots are also a plan of subdivision. I don't know whether the lots have been deemed not to be part of a registered plan of subdivision, but we cannot transfer any land between these two lots unless council passes a deeming bylaw. It's illegal. You can't change the configuration of plan of lots within a plan of subdivision unless council deems the lots not to be part of a registered plan of subdivision. This council has done a number of deeming bylaws throughout the years. But to give title assurance to these the two owners, we should do it properly. And the other matter was, I think the draft bylaw that I saw was that the setbacks from the interior side yards were 3.5 meters. Well, the accessory buildings, like the garage, the existing bylaw allows for a 3-meter setback, so why are we making it bigger? And I don't believe that the garage is 3.5 meters away from the side lot line of 193 Manitou Drive. I think it's about a meter or less. And remember, this consent was applied for when there was no garage. That was the reason for the lot addition, was to allow the building of the garage. And it took place basically without the benefit of a permit and without the zoning being undertaken. And the consent lapsed. But I'm just suggesting, as outlined in my letter, we should do it properly.
Okay, well, let Rebecca respond first of all, and then we have a member of the audience here too.
Thank you, and through you, Mr. Chair, I have a couple of responses. On the matter of whether the land is within a plan of subdivision, that would be something I would recommend the planning board look into more closely. I would recommend that it relates more to the lot creation that was proposed through the consent application rather than the zoning bylaw amendment that's at hand right now. And so I would defer any comments on whether a deeming bylaw is required to the planning board as the consent granting authority. The other comments raised by Mr. Davidson with respect to the requirements in the zoning bylaw for the minimum frontage on a public road or other road allowance, that can form part of the amending bylaw so as to extend relief to the remnant parcel. So that can form part of the special provisions that are noted for that property. And that essentially would still maintain the intent and purpose of those official plan policies that I mentioned earlier. And with respect to the setbacks that are provided for in the amending bylaw for both the retained and benefiting lots, those are based on the existing locations of buildings and structures as noted on the plan of survey, or the draft plan of survey rather, that was provided with the application, and based on the distances that were appropriate. So that's where those are coming from.
Appreciate that, because no, you are correct. I mean, our chief building official did issue the permit, and
we closed the permit. The permit for the garage is now closed, so it's finished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else from council, the public? Councilman Zulak?
Patrick is on, right?
Oh, Patrick's on.
Yes. Could we ask him about the plan of subdivision?
Oh, the deeming bylaw?
Yeah.
That would be good, because it's interesting. I think Mr. Davidson is correct. The township, I was part of it years ago, we had a number of deeming bylaws. And there was always that question of whether the planning board does it, whether the township does it. I just know in the past township did do it. So I don't remember any from the planning board, but there may be. Maybe Patrick can speak to that.
Through you, Mr. Chair, the any deeming bylaw has been done through the township or the municipality. These lots, I believe, are lots in a PSR plan, which I do not believe is the same as a plan of subdivision. I don't believe that a deeming bylaw would be necessary, but that's something I need to look into.
Excuse me.
Okay.
Just, Patrick, what did you say, a PSR?
Yes, sir.
So you want to know what the difference is?
Yeah. Can you tell me the difference, Patrick, between a plan of subdivision and a PSR?
I could not officially, but I do not believe that a PSR is a plan that has the same status as lots and plans.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Mayor, I was under the understanding that all of Tate's Island was done by way of planned subdivision, and the center portion, in fact, of Tate's Island is co-owned by all of the shoreline properties, and there's an association, an incorporated association, that administers that central portion of Tate's Island. And the roads must have been, at some point in time, conveyed to the municipality. I'm just saying that If we don't know, we should check. Because you cannot transfer the lands without, from a plan of subdivision unless you deem it not to be a plan of subdivision.
Well, that's fair enough. I'm just wondering, and of course I was, well, I guess I was around, but I wasn't old enough to know what was going on there when it was developed. Could it have been developed in stages? I know some of our subdivisions were. And is there a possibility that some of it may have been done through plan of subdivision and then somebody else came in and finished it through another method?
Well, if you recall, there are a lot of lots, for example, you know how Fox Farm Road got extended?
Yes.
There's Silver Fox, Gray Fox, and whatever, White Fox, or whatever they are down there. All of those lots were water access lots at one time.
Right.
But they were all part of a plan of subdivision. Those, and they had only water access. And council just a few years ago did a deeming bylaw when one of the Fergusons wanted to transfer some property from them to a neighbor. And council has done these, and in Bailey subdivision, for example, I think council passed deeming bylaws to deem most of those lots within the Bailey subdivision not to be part of lots within a plan subdivision. And there's other examples throughout the township, but it's a council responsibility, not a planning board responsibility.
Councilor Zula?
Would it not say on their deed or on their, if it's a plan of subdivision?
No, not really. It would just usually give a part lot number. For example, on the Inn Road where my lot is, it's part lot 7 of 42M550. It won't say whether it's a plan of subdivision or not, but I'm assuming that at the time, the Minister of Housing or Municipal Affairs or whatever we call it at the time, was responsible for the plans of subdivision within the township. Before the planning board was brought into existence. But it's worthwhile checking to make sure that the transfers between the two properties are correct.
Okay, so a question about...
You want, at the end of the day, you want valid title for both properties.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I'm just back to Patrick, what would be involved, and the time element in this as well. Just to investigate.
Right, through you, Mr. Mayor, we could certainly look into whether a PSR does constitute a plan of subdivision, and if the lots do need to be deemed not to be lots in a plan of subdivision, we could definitely let council know and get a bylaw drafted to do so.
I think as part of my letter to Mr. Mayor, I included the application for a deeming bylaw.
Yes.
As well as I was under the understanding that a surveyor's real property report was to be filed with the zoning application. I haven't seen the zoning application. I don't know. Normally, the zoning applications are put on the council agenda for council's information. But I haven't seen one, so I don't know whether there's a real surveyor's real property report that was filed. I've seen the draft survey, which is incomplete, that forms part of the report, but I don't know whether there was a more detailed survey that was done.
I'm not sure whether Charlie wants to speak to that. Council has, we questioned that as well, and council has information from our CBO, I believe, and who else? That was a real property survey?
Our CBO had said that what was accepted did have the same information that a real property or surveyor report would have. It didn't have any verbiage or a written report, but it had all of the measurements that were required from the township to make a decision on the application.
Mr. Mayor, if I may add, I know that the real surveyor's property or report is a requirement as one of the conditions of the consent application, but does not necessarily need to be addressed through the application to amend the bylaw. That can be something that's submitted independently. It didn't necessarily need to form part of the complete application. The survey that was prepared and submitted with the application to amend the zoning bylaw did show all of the information that was needed to review and consider the application. So I think that we need to be careful and not blending the two matters together. The items under consideration for the consent application are certainly important to contextualize the zoning amendment, but I think we need to keep them distinct for the purpose of tonight's discussion.
But I'm trying to clarify. I thought our resolution, now maybe Carly, I don't really have it available, I thought it was almost concurrent the way it was worded, that they had to come together?
That's correct, Mr. Mayor. In fact, it was also a resolution of the Calgary Council that the real surveyor's property be filed concurrent with the zoning application.
Right. So I'm not sure how you could separate the two, Rebecca, but one could come later.
It was my understanding that I wasn't aware of the verbiage within the condition that required it as part of the zoning amendment.
Yeah, well, what we're going on, I guess, is what Carly had just said, that from what our CBO has said, we did receive that. It's essentially the same, and now we're hearing that maybe it's not. So council's caught in this. We're going through our staff and what they're telling us, and if that satisfies the conditions, then that's fine. Council has to make that call, I guess.
Well, Mr. Mayor, could I ask, has council seen the actual zoning amendment application?
Got it there.
Yes.
Okay, well, I mean, I couldn't find it on any of the agendas, but maybe it was not included in the agenda. But
I know that's something we've been working with, that, as you've noted over the past little while, too, that we were talking about posting that as part of the application, that the application itself be included on the website. It is not happening, I guess, on a regular basis.
Well, it would be normal, in my experience, Mr. Mayor, it would be normal if you're preparing a planning report on a zoning application to include the application along with the zoning report. And then you can determine that. I think the real property survey was to make sure that the setbacks from the rear property line, which isn't in the bylaw now, so it has to be added, 1.8 meters, because the setback that's in the draft zoning bylaw before you is 3.5 meters.
Pass that back to Rebecca, because I think she mentioned 1.8.
That's correct, she did. But the bylaw that's before you on the agenda says that the minimum setbacks would be 3.5 meters.
Right.
Through you, Mr. Mayor, I believe you're referring to the, I'm just going to pull up the bylaw in front of me. There are two different exception zones, one for the remnant parcel and one for the benefiting parcel. And I just want to make sure that we're not confusing them. So I'm just going to pull it up in front of me so that I can use it properly. It's just opening now. In either case, I can make sure that any necessary amendments can be made. It is normal practice for council to consider endorsing the application should you wish to do so, and bringing the draft amendment at a subsequent meeting, pending any necessary changes that might be required. I'd be happy to do so.
I guess the question is, if if you're already approving it, what would be the need for the amendment? Are you talking two readings as opposed to three? Is that? Because once you've done the complete the bylaw, then you can't make any amendments after your third reading.
Through you, Mr. Chair, what I was referring to is not passing the amendment at tonight's meeting, but rather you can have a resolution on the agenda and then bring it forward to a subsequent meeting to have that final reading and choose to adopt the bylaw if council decides to pursue that matter.
Okay, and the other question is, while these various things are being investigated, what does that do to the muir heads and the property as far as, like I say, the garage is there, it's all legal, and so the timing here, maybe Patrick can help on this too. Are we running out of time to get this resolved? Or?
No, I think we've got a year and a half.
Patrick, your voice has changed.
Yeah, that is correct. Because this is a new application, we do have time. I would just like to comment that as far as the content of what a real property report would have, I have seen sketches that show all of the structures on the property, and we do have a surveyor's sketch that shows the location of the garage and its setbacks where they are currently, and that's not something that would be normally on normal plan of survey, only on a real property report.
Now, there was some question on those properties that you mentioned, the various sheds and buildings that are on there, that it only showed one side as opposed to all the dimensions. Is that true too? Or?
That's what I saw anyways, but I don't think all of the buildings were complete. And I think that there's a recommendation for a 9-meter setback from the high water mark 193, but it doesn't show the survey showing the high water mark and the setback of that building, which is, I think, the main cottage on 193.
Okay.
But I didn't understand why the accessory buildings, the yards for an accessory building are now 3 meters from the property lines. And why would we increase them to 3.5 when it appears on the survey that the closest one is over 4 meters from the property line, other than the garage. And the garage should have, with the survey, should have that 1.8 meter for the rear yard. And also, I think there's a discrepancy with, I think it's closer to 3.5 meters to the new side lot line in that lot addition.
193, the cottage was built probably in the 70s, so I don't know what the rules was about the high water. I mean, we didn't move the cottage at 193. It is there. There's some sheds that on that property, and there's a garage. They've been in existence forever. The property was purchased by us, well, by my son, in 2021. So it was whatever the planning was there. The other one, the 195, there is a bunkie and there's a little shed, which I'm not on near the water, but it's been there. We bought that place in 2016, 2015. They've been there forever. The only new structure is the garage, which I said we had the permit for, and was inspected, and the permit is closed, so the garage is there. So I'm not sure what else can you do to deal with this particular issue.
Well, maybe all we're getting at, I'm not sure here, but...
sorry, one more comment.
Yep.
There was a comment made about ownership of the middle of the Tides Island.
Exactly.
So not everybody on the island owns the middle. We are not one of the owners. You had to, when this, from what my understanding is, back in the 70s when this thing was being developed, if you paid some money in to this corporation, you were part owner. If you did not pay the money, you are not part owner. We are not part owner of that, of the middle of the island. So it's half our neighbors are and half our neighbors are not. It's not standard.
Okay, good information. Thank you. I'm thinking what we're getting at, not that it's going to make any difference necessarily, but that it be accurate. I think that's what we're looking at for distances from shoreline, from side yard, and that sort of thing, that it be accurate, and then it be actually worded that way in the bylaw so that it's more with what it actually exists rather than what should be. As you say, some of those have been there forever, so we're not about to change the buildings, and just to acknowledge where they are and the distance.
I think what we're attempting to do, Mr. Mayor, is just legalize these two lots. None of the lots on Tate's Island none of them are conforming. They're all zoned WF2, which requires 90 meters of frontage. We know that the majority of those lots only have 30 meters of frontage.
Right.
We're just trying to legalize these two lots for the benefit of these two owners to make sure that the cottage, which if it's set back 9 meters from the high water mark instead of 10, we're going to legalize that. The garage we're going to legalize, and then the cottage on the 195 we're going to legalize, and all the outbuildings, the smaller buildings, are going to be legal now. So they won't have this issue of non-conformity hanging over their heads.
Yep. Thank you. So Rebecca, what were you suggesting for our steps for tonight when we come out of the public meeting?
Through you, Mr. Mayor, I would recommend as council whether you choose to support the application. You could prepare a resolution to direct staff to bring forward an amending bylaw, which considers the reduced lot frontage, reduced lot area, reduced minimum front yard, reduced minimum interior side yard, and reduced minimum rear yard for the benefiting and retained lots, and for that bylaw to be presented to council at a subsequent meeting for adoption.
Okay, thank you. Well, just currently was writing while you were speaking, so.
Happy to repeat that, and the wording doesn't need to be exactly what I just iterated.
It's certainly later in the agenda, we have to come out of the public meeting, but I just want to make sure that we have enough things to look at the amending bylaw, enough things included. I guess that would be the next step. Putting some of the ideas that came out tonight into that bylaw. Like the one that's concerning, of course, is the deeming bylaw as well, and Patrick can look into that. Any other comments at this stage?
Mr. Mayor, the planning board gave provisional consent to a lot addition that is different than the one that's now being asked for. I don't think there'll be an issue at the planning board about it, but you should be aware that it's different than the one that the planning board adopted back in March. And the property is growing a bit bigger. Patrick is going to need to have a survey done of the new lot addition. The old lot addition that was being transferred was surveyed and has an R plan number. I think it's 42R21921 or something. And it's part one of that plan. There'll have to be a new R plan done because the planning board will want the survey deposited. And I think it's part of the recommendation. And I think that the schedule of the bylaws should be based on the new lots rather than, because the descriptions right now of the lots that are being used are the legal descriptions of 193 and 195 without the lot addition, or minus the lot without the lot addition being added, and without the lot addition being taken away from the plan. So we'll have two new legal descriptions. And that helps, I think, the CBO and future, when you want to sell in the future, yes, the zoning applies to these lands. And it's got a proper legal description. But you can ask Patrick. I think Patrick may still be here. He's going to have to require or have a new survey deposited. And you may want to ask him if the planning board sees any issue with respect to the new lot addition. I don't know whether he can answer that, but you might be.
To you, Mr. Mayor, the current application that was applied for this year did consider the lot addition as it's shown on the sketches with the existing garage. So the lot addition before you is the lot addition that has provisional consent.
No.
And
no.
Go ahead, Patrick. All right, Patrick, finish first.
Yep, sorry.
I believe that it is. I believe that the discussion that was included with the new application of this year is the sketch that shows the existing.